listening to CITR News, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Armand Rana.
And I'm Akhil Krishnan. It's Saturday, the 26th of March at 11:01 a.m. We're recording this episode from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkmiyim-speaking Musqueam people.
City elections are around the corner, and municipal parties are finalizing their nominations. Today, we are speaking to Ian Cromwell, who was recently nominated as a city council candidate by One City.
Ian Cromwell is a health economist and musician. He is also the founder of Locals Lounge, which seeks to build social connections in Vancouver using the connecting power of live music.
Thanks so much for taking the time to meet with us today.
That's exciting. I'm glad to be here.
To start us off, could you tell us a bit more about yourself and what motivated you to run for office?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was born in Vancouver. I'm one of the few, it turns out. But I moved away. I lived in the suburbs of, like, in the 905 area of Ontario for a number of years, did a couple of degrees out east, and moved back at the end of 2009. And I didn't have strong social connections here when I arrived, but I played music, and that meant that I got to be welcomed into a community of people who also play and love local music. And my introduction to the city was through the live music scene. And I was able to make social connections really easily and sort of get connected to the city and discover its, you know, its underground culture scene. And what I came to realize over a number of years is that wasn't a common experience for a lot of people. They found it a difficult city to get oriented and to get connected to. And so that's when I started Locals Lounge, which is sort of an opportunity to introduce regular everyday Vancouverites to their own backyard music scene, their own underground, their own indie artists, because there's this incredible reservoir of talent here. And I've been doing that for 4 years before the pandemic hit. And right before the pandemic hit, I finished my PhD in population and public health at UBC. And my area is health economics. And we look at, like, value for money and what should we be spending public funds on that's going to give us the biggest health return. And one of the things that you know, one of the things that you learn as a healthcare researcher, or just a health researcher in general, is how influential the social determinants of health are. And so that's things like early childhood education, environmental safety, but also whether or not you are connected to your community. And that modest investments in bringing people closer together can have really outsized returns if we invest in the kinds of things that bring us together. And so that was the work that I continued doing through the pandemic, both professionally on the pharmaceutical policy side, and then just locally trying to keep people connected and keep the community thriving at a time when we were all socially disconnected from each other. And we are seeing a lot of different overlapping crises happening right now. There's the climate emergency, and we've got, you know, barges beaching themselves around the city. We've got heat domes, we've got floods, we've got fires. It's a serious, serious, serious set of calamities that the climate disaster has brought us. And the response to that does include a social piece of people opening their doors for people who have been displaced by the fires and the floods, people looking out for each other, checking in on their neighbors during the heat domes, and just making sure that we can build a response that is rooted in the lived realities of people who live here. At the same time, we're facing a drug poisoning crisis, where people who were pushed to the margins of our society are disproportionately dying. It's a literal life and death issue, and the policies that are being proposed as response are not sufficient to actually address that emergency. But again, that comes from who we consider our neighbors and who we think about when we think about who is worthy of our response. And then, weird as it is to say, there is this rise in global fascism, which is, again, it sounds hyperbolic, but it is a literal thing that is literally happening. And fascist movements are bred from social discontent and social disconnection and being able to demonize a certain group of undesirables. And the answer to fighting all of these things is to create stronger social connections and to create a more integrated and equal society. And, you know, having this particular background in public policy investment, having this particular background in community building around the arts, and then just being someone who loves the city, who just loves living in Vancouver. I think I can help. And I think that one city has the same set of values that I do. And that if not now, then when? And I think that we're all sort of feeling this pressure of what to do, how to respond to all of these things. And I think the answer is for us to turn towards each other. And so this is me trying to do that.
Let's jump right in. For most voters, given the large number of municipal parties currently in Vancouver City Council, one issue is distinguishing political parties. Why did you choose to run for one city rather than COPE or the Green Party?
The easy answer to that question is because they asked me. I've been a supporter of one city for a number of years. I supported their slate of candidates in the 2018 election. I've been a donor and a party member for a long time, so it certainly made sense for me to run with the party that I feel most at home with. I think that there is a lot more that unites a lot of the municipal parties in Vancouver than divides them. And I think that what it's going to come down to is who can tell the most compelling and inviting story to bring people into the process rather than just hyping up and making a lot of hay out of the differences that divide the parties. I think that we see low levels of municipal electoral participation. There's a lot of reasons, some of which are structural and some of which just have to do with who is actually going to put in the work to get out there. One city is my home. One city is where I see my beliefs and my values reflected. And in my conversations with them, when it was time to decide whether or not I was going to run in the first place, those conversations ended with an invitation. And that was one that I was proud to respond to.
I see that's very interesting. So it's more like, you know, you kind of see them as just different vehicles for more or less the same agenda. And I think you also touched on, the structural issues in the voting system in Vancouver, which we'll get to in a moment. But I want to follow up on something you mentioned a while earlier, which are the myriad crises that we're facing in Vancouver. We'll start with housing. So BC Housing Minister David Eby has proposed enforcing minimum amounts of housing approvals based on population growth for municipalities. What is your perspective on this? And more broadly, how should we be tackling this crisis?
It's an emergency. And I think we need to be open and honest about what that means. COVID was an emergency. COVID continues to be an emergency. And we brought into being and changed policies, longstanding policies, in a rapid and urgent way because we recognized that it was a life and death situation for Canadians, for people around the world. Housing is a life or death situation for Vancouverites. And many of the problems, whether you're housed or unhoused, many of the problems facing the city are rooted in housing scarcity. And I am in favor of solutions that are on the scale of the problem rather than ones that tinker around the edges. I think it is a shame that we are in a position where the province has to come in and overrule local control. I don't feel comfortable with that idea. At the same time, I think that there is a certain amount of inertia that is built into our municipal decision-making processes that favors those who are currently comfortable and who face the least consequences of the housing scarcity, rather than the solutions being scaled at those who are experiencing the worst outcomes and the most serious problems. And if we cannot find a way to solve this problem, then there needs to be an investment and an action from other forms of government, from superior forms of government. But I still want to see. I don't think that this is a problem that we can't solve. I think we just have to build the political will and articulate real solutions and get people to recognize that solving the housing problem solves a lot of their other problems that they're complaining about.
So just to follow up on that, like what would those real solutions look like from your perspective?
A rapid increase in the amount of housing in all neighborhoods in the city. So rather than only building on arterials or only areas where it's zoned to have multifamily dwellings, I think we need to look at the percentage of the city. I think it's something like 80% that is exclusively single family housing, and recognize that those areas need to be densified, not only because of the housing scarcity, but because that has a climate impact as well. Single family dwellings are disproportionately resource intensive, and we are not serving ourselves well. Not only that, but it distorts the local economy and the provincial economy to protect these the increasing value or sale value of these multi-million dollar properties. And by introducing new people into different neighborhoods, we also have the opportunity to build new kinds of social connection. So in a concrete way, I want to see increased density, increased housing variety, and an urgent recognition that the status quo is causing the same problems that we are trying to solve through other means like policing and through, we have these conversations about public safety that don't recognize the role that poverty plays in crime.
So you touched on this in your previous answer, but continuing on the climate crisis now. So even after the newly introduced climate levy, the city's $500 million climate emergency action plan is not fully funded. Council previously fell short of approving a parking fee for overnight parking as recommended by city staff, primarily because Mayor Kenny Stewart voted it down. What funding options would you pursue for the climate emergency?
I think we have to recognize, firstly, that the city does have an actual jurisdictional restriction on what we can spend on, and that's an extremely frustrating reality. And so, real climate action does have to come with support from the federal and provincial governments. The voting down of the climate plan, I think, was a real not just a shame, but a missed opportunity to take meaningful action. I support the change in the city that I've seen over the time, the 12 years that I've lived here, to make it a more walkable, more bikeable, and more transit-friendly place. And that's where I'd like to see a rapid increase and a change in attitude towards building more walkable neighborhoods, which means densifying neighborhoods, which means increasing transit options, which means building more cycling and walking infrastructure, and decentralizing cars, making private vehicles the exception rather than the rule when we think about getting around within the city. As far as where that revenue comes from, I think we need to look at what we're currently spending in our budget and whether or not we are getting full value for it. Something like 20% of the city's budget is going towards policing, and the Vancouver Police Department themselves have said that a lot of that money is spent on policing climate protests. And so it seems a little hypocritical for us to say we want to be a greenest city, but we're spending millions of dollars a year stopping people from raising climate issues. So I think that we need to look not only at finding new sources of revenue, like the climate levy, like eliminating free parking, but also sources of revenue like provincial and federal funding, and then reallocating resources that we're currently spending and having those go towards things that actually make a difference.
So another exigent challenge, Ian, is the opioid epidemic. The death toll due to illicit drug overdoses far exceeds that due to COVID-19 in the province, with the majority of those overdose deaths in the city of Vancouver. The province and the city are engaged in mitigating the spread and use of illicit drugs. How would you bring your perspective as a health economist to bear on this crisis?
So, Akhil, I want to just gently push back, because you characterize this as an opioid epidemic. And while that may have been true a few years ago, what we are facing now is a drug poisoning crisis. It is not that people are using and overusing opioids. It's that they do not know what is in their drugs. The drug supply is tainted with all kinds of extremely toxic substances and drugs that are not dose controlled. And as a consequence of that, people are dying. And that's not about the type of drugs that they're using. It's about what's in the drugs that are available. So I think we need to recognize what the actual parameters of the problem are before we can start proposing solutions. I am certainly a proponent of the idea of safe supply as a method of ensuring that people actually know what's in the substances that they're taking. I realize that safe supply does not solve all of the problems, but it certainly does solve the problem of people not knowing what they're taking. And that's going to have a radical improvement in the death rate. We're going to see a lot fewer people dying as a result of that one simple policy. There are a number of really smart, motivated, and knowledgeable, skilled health economists in Vancouver, many of whom are studying the effects of things like safe supply, of needle exchange programs like Insight, or safe injection sites like Insight. And I think a lot of the answers to how we address these problems are either knowable or already known. But I think we also have to look at, and this goes back to my earlier comments about the social determinants of health, we need to look at what it is that's causing people to be using drugs. Some of that is just they like taking drugs, and that's like, I like smoking weed. Lots of people in my network like taking drugs. It's not like a lot of us are drug users. People who have lack of access to a safe and consistent supply of drugs, and people who are taking drugs for reasons that are causing major disruptions in their life, we have to look at some of the reasons that underpin that, which include poverty, which include things like intergenerational trauma, which include housing scarcity, and recognize that people are using drugs for reasons, and that understanding those reasons is the key to making sure that people are spared the worst outcomes of what's going on. But this is a multifaceted problem, and it's going to require far-reaching solutions.
Well, and as you said, there are there are almost two disparate issues of the toxicity of the drugs they're using themselves and why they're using these drugs in the first place.
Yeah.
And so what are your thoughts on the effort to decriminalize simple possession of illicit drugs in Vancouver?
I don't really know what we get as a society by criminalizing drug use. I don't know why it makes, I don't know, as someone who does not use heroin, fentanyl, cocaine, I don't understand why my life is better because someone who does use those substances is in jail. That to me doesn't make sense. I would like someone to articulate a good argument for criminalization. And if we don't have a good argument for criminalization, then decriminalization is the obvious answer. I don't know why we are better off putting people in jail.
Moving to something that has a very strong impact on drug users is policing. And policing accounts for over 20% of the city's budget. And the Vancouver Police Department recently won an appeal to restore $5.6 million in funding to their 2022 budget, which is approximately 2% of the annual budget of the VPD. This was originally cut as part of the funding freeze proposed by your One City colleague, Christine Boyle. What does this decision mean for City Council oversight of the VPD?
I was surprised to learn and shocked and dismayed to learn that there is no democratic accountability for the Vancouver Police at all. The police board is not made up of elected representatives, short of the chair, the mayor acting as chair, but that is not a position that gets to overrule what the rest of the police board does. And this latest act, this move by the province, has basically said that the police are, we have to pay for the police, but we are not allowed to have any oversight in terms of how that money is spent. I think that's a shame. I think that is it should be raising alarm bells, whether or not whatever your attitude is towards policing as an institution. I think it should raise a lot of alarm bells that we, as the people who are subject to the police, don't have any say whatsoever in how they behave. That's a problem. It's very interesting. I have, you know, this background in pharmaceutical policy and a lot of the arguments around policing remind me very much of the arguments that are made by Big Pharma of, you know, if we don't spend what we ask for, if you don't give us the money that we want, well, then, you know, the whole thing will fall apart. You'll miss out on all these really great things. And then when you ask for the evidence of the great things, it's, well, you know, you just don't want people to be safe. That's kind of the response. I think that's as childish and belligerent and like just factually inaccurate. The kinds of things that I'd love to see us spend money on are things like the Better Together Neighborhood Collective Action Pilot. This was something that was just passed by council, which is a form of community training, neighborhood specific community training, to allow people to empower people to respond to when their neighbors are in crisis rather than going to the police. They can intervene or they can have resources that will allow them to enhance public safety in their own neighborhoods and have people-based control over public safety. Now we're talking about a two-year cost of less than $700,000. Imagine if a project like that was putting tools in the hands of the people had the kind of funding that the police are asking for as they make arguments about what they should do to like what it costs for them to do public safety. You know, to me as a health economist, I want to look at, well, what are we getting for the money that we're spending? And that's why I'm really excited about this pilot, because the pilot itself is going to give us some information about what the needs of different neighborhoods in Vancouver are and how much the policy has made a difference. We don't have that kind of information from VPD and we're unlikely to get it because, again, of this absence of democratic oversight.
And you know, continuing on what you said, Christine Boyle said that, you know, City Council's, quote, priority is to be addressing public safety in more community-oriented ways, unquote. What are some other community-oriented interventions you propose? And I say this with the context that, you know, overall, crime has been going down in recent years, even though in the pandemic, there have been a lot more widely reported instances of stranger attacks.
So this is a very long and very complicated conversation. I'm going to try to hit the high points just because I think crime in the city is down. Crime in certain neighborhoods is up. Different kinds of crimes are up in different kinds of neighborhoods. And that is influenced, according to a paper published earlier this year, an academic paper published earlier this year, that is due to structural inequalities that exist within different neighborhoods. And the pandemic has sort of exacerbated those. So while the overall trend of crime is down, I don't think people are wrong to notice that crime is changing in the city. But when it comes to stranger attacks, we also have to look at, well, what could solve that problem? What is the, like the policing answer to that problem would be what are we talking about? Having police on every block in every restaurant to make sure that no one ever has the opportunity, because that's not what police do. They don't prevent crime for the most part. There's the evidence on that is complex, but generally speaking, we're not talking about a direct linear relationship between police spending and crime rates. It just doesn't exist. So we need to be looking at things at the level where these things are happening, which is why I'm a little hesitant to propose specific solutions that I have. I know a lot about health economics. I know a lot about music. I know a lot about community building. I don't know what it's going to take to solve graffiti related crimes in Chinatown, right? I don't live in Chinatown. I'm not familiar with the specific issues of that neighborhood. I think that there are people who are in the city who are doing this work, who need to be brought in, who need to be consulted, who need to be listened to, and that our response should be driven by the people who live in the neighborhoods that are affected by the problems, rather than imposed by well-meaning, egg-headed city councilors like me, or council candidates like me. I think that the response to any problem is found by listening to those who are most directly affected by it. And then looking in the literature, looking across what other cities have done, what other jurisdictions have done, what works to solve this particular problem or that particular problem. And our priorities should also be set by the communities themselves. So it's a complex situation, but I think that more than anything, a sense of safety in the city is restored by building trust and building social connection between people so that they, when they walk down the street, they feel at home. They don't feel as though they're under siege. And I know that for a lot of people, particularly people who have been sheltering indoors for the past 2 years, the outside world is a scary place. And we need to restore vitality to neighborhoods. We need to restore connectivity to neighborhoods. We need to bring people's sense of civic responsibility and belonging to the forefront, and empower them with the tools to make change in their communities. That, I think, is the way to address not only the problem of crime, but the issues of public safety, both real and perceived.
So kind of looping back to something you mentioned a while earlier, which was the voting system. So Vancouver has an at-large voting system for city councillors, meaning that about 10 or so councillors represent the whole of Vancouver. Charlie Smith, the editor of the Georgia Strait, has often argued that the system discriminates against minorities and those with non-European surnames. What are your thoughts on this voting system, and how are you navigating this as a candidate?
I think it's interesting and a shame that Vancouver's elected representatives have not represented Vancouver's diversity. As a Black Vancouverite myself, I know that the issues that are affecting the people from my community don't often make it into the council chamber, and that we're not seeing people who are deeply in touch with those communities bringing those to the fore. I think people are trying. I don't think that it's for a lack of effort, but I think that in the absence of having lived these issues, they become one issue among many rather than something that is of central importance. So I think there's definitely work that needs to be done. I think the systemic problems that are caused by the at-large voting system are reflective of just the general attitude towards policymaking, which is that a small and unrepresentative handful of residents of this city who have an outsized amount of power, outsized amount of money, and an outsized amount of influence are making decisions that affect everyone in the city for the benefit of a unrepresentative small group. I think that proportional representation systems help. They are certainly, the evidence suggests that they produce fairer outcomes, but part of the issue is getting people to vote and welcoming people and activating people and inviting people into the process so that they see it as something that they are not just subject to, but they have a voice in. I think one of the things, just a quick example of how sort of systems that are non-representative function, we saw a lot of the messaging during the pandemic, a lot of the COVID messaging was exclusively in English. Well, we don't live in an exclusively English province. And so we saw gaps, knowledge gaps, information gaps that were disproportionately affecting certain communities more than others. I think the city tries but does not make a top priority an inclusive approach to democracy, of going to those groups who are not fully represented, going to those groups who are not fully participating, and saying, what do we need to change in order to invite your participation? Because the beautiful thing about Vancouver is that there's so many different people who live here, so many different kinds of groups living side by side. And we have this incredible diversity, this wealth, this amazing resource, that if we start to tap in, invest in it, recognize it and see it as a strength rather than a cute feature or something to say nice slogans about and then ignore. If we actually take advantage of what we have here, we can bring in perspectives and solutions from cultures that haven't mixed before, and we can build solutions that are actually representative of huge amounts of people. So changing the structure of the voting system is certainly an important approach to that. But I think also we need to change how we think of voting and where we place representative democracy on our collective set of priorities. That if we think it's important and we act like it's important, we can reap the benefits of that as well.
So would you so you mentioned a proportional representation system. There's been discussions about moving to a ward system. Would you be in favor of that? What are your thoughts on the different voting systems? And
I mean, to me, a ward system is better than what we currently have. But I don't think that a ward system solves the problems that we have, because unless our neighborhoods are somewhat racially balkanized, but it's not the case that a ward system is instantaneously going to produce representative democracy. It will, like I said, it will be better, and it will change the behavior of elected officials so that they will be representing their communities. But you know, Toronto has a ward system. Toronto's city council does not look like Toronto. So a ward system is certainly not the only solution that we need to be looking at.
Could you comment, on what is your perspective on how the city has been run, and more broadly the last year's even council beyond the mayor? What is your perspective on what kind of job?
I think that for the most part, city councilors are sincerely motivated by wanting to make the city better. I think some of them are more thoughtful in their approach to making the city better than others. And I think that sometimes people's ideologies, either fully baked or half baked, cause them to make decisions that, while perhaps sincerely motivated, don't actually make life better for people. I think there is a tendency among certain city councilors to say no to things without offering an alternative. So this is that sort of inertia that I was speaking to before, where saying no is easy. There's always flaws. There's always things that you can say, this is not perfect, and so I don't support it. But if you don't have, if you're not offering an alternative, then what you're voting for is the status quo. There is a cost of inaction, and we are all paying it. I would like to see a council that has an idea of what the city should look like and a vision for the city's future. And there are some people who are not, in my opinion, doing the city a great service in terms of what they are saying yes and what they are saying no to. But I am optimistic that by involving a more representative group of the city to participate in this next civic election, and by expanding who we think of as being inside Vancouver politics, that we can break some of these log jams and maybe move some of these people, some of the folks who are supported by this sort of non-representative, very loud and very well-resourced minority, that they will be, their voices will become more marginal because they don't represent us. But that requires democratic action, both leading up to and including and following the balloting process.
Thanks for that. Yeah, maybe with your aversion to saying no, maybe you should be running for Yes Vancouver rather than one city.
I didn't make my choice based on the name of the party, but there is a certain parsimony there.
Thanks for your time today, Ian. Is there anything else about One City or otherwise you would like to highlight before we drop?
We had a really interesting open nomination process, and I think what is going to contrast One City against some of the other parties is who we have brought in as representatives, including myself, who is a relative political outsider. I'm not someone who is known to the political class in Vancouver. I have been doing work on behalf of the city as a private citizen for 6 years. I have been involved in city politics as a voter, as a donor, as someone who pays attention. But I'm not part of the political class. We've elected 4 city council candidates who come from very different backgrounds, who are coming in with wildly different sets of overlapping expertise. This was the result of an open, fair, and democratic process within One City. We saw a ton of great candidates, nominees come forward, and we had a really strong consensus around who the membership wanted to see. And what they wanted to see was a diverse, dynamic, energized group of people who are sincerely committed to making the city a better place. And I'm really, really excited about the energy and the passion that I see, not only in my fellow candidates, but in the membership that has supported us up until now, and that will be supporting us going forward. So if you are listening to this and you're someone who cares about the city and wants to help, we want to hear from you. If you think that cities are for people, then we are your home, and I want to meet you.
Thanks so much, Ian. That brings us to the end of today's show. To close, you can find us on CITR News on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So check us out there.
This episode was edited by myself, Akhil Krishnan, and my co-host, Arman Reiner. The music in this piece is by Sarah Pratt. You can find her on SoundCloud at the handle Leisure Noise. The link is in the description. Please subscribe to our podcast for future episodes, and thank you for listening.